start. Well, first of all, thanks for letting me speak here. It's a very nice conference so far, and I hope I can contribute something to it. So my name is Shabo. Pronounce it. You can think of the J as an H. It might make it easier to pronounce for me.
And the B's as V's.
For in some languages.
Is it Shabo or Shavo?
Shavo.
Oh, it is B. Okay.
And yeah. Can you pronounce the rest?
That's Dutch, so schaveling.
Schaveling.
Schaveling, yes.
Schaveling.
Alright.
And the rest?
So this is where I live now. It's the Mathematical Institute in Leiden. That's where I'm Roland's PhD student. So the title of my talk is Quantum Enveloping Algebras, which is slightly wrong because this many people call this quantized enveloping algebras, and I was used to calling it quantum enveloping algebras because I heard the word quantum everywhere. So that's why it's still in the title. And to get at these quantum or quantized enveloping algebras, I will first explain something about this Lie-Bai algebras in the following way. So I'll set up the Lie-Bai algebra formalism and tell you a little bit about the classical double, and then I will go on to the Hopf algebras and the quantum double, although I won't tell you much of the definitions because you already know them. So I'll mainly focus on the quantum double construction. And then I will talk about quantization of Lie-Bai algebras and Hopf algebras. There's lots to do, and I will give a very easy example, the quantum Heisenberg algebra. And so in the title on the internet, in the Mathemale program, it was something about an SL2. So I have incorporated this, but I'm not sure if I will get to it. But my main focus here is to try to explain to you how to calculate this quantum double and how to do things with it and give some easy tricks. So that's really the focus here, and not to just show you these relations, because that's very boring. In the end, you want to compute something yourself. So, so I, in my life, I use two main references. So this is a book by Sean Magid, which I find very useful, and this is by Chari and Presley, roughly about the same stuff. There's some overlap, but they explain things a little bit different, and I like these books. And all of the things I tell you can be found in those books too. And together they give a very nice picture of the, at least the Hopf algebra and Lie-Bai algebra side of things. Alright, so let's get started. So part one. I suppose many of you know what a Lie algebra is. So a Lie-Bai algebra is a Lie algebra together with a linear map from G to G tensor G, and this is called a co-bracket. And together they have to obey some conditions. Of course, you know the Lie algebra conditions. On the other hand, delta, the co-bracket, has to be skew symmetric, meaning that if we switch the entries, it will be minus itself. So you could call it anti-symmetric. And we want the a dual of this co-bracket to be a bracket on the dual Lie-Bai algebra. Yes.
Excuse me. Delta takes one variable and gives two. So what does it mean swapping? What does it mean?
Oh, I mean in the final. So if you, for example, take a delta of x, this takes values in G tensor G, right?
Yeah.
And if you swap these two,
okay,
then it has to be minus.
Minus.
Okay. So you can define tau, which tau of x tensor y will be y tensor x, and then you will You can write it as tau applied to delta of minus delta if you continue this linearly. Error? And this last condition, this is an interesting one. This states that delta is a co-cycle in the Lie Bai algebra cohomology, one co-cycle. And I won't tell you what this cohomology is because it's too much details, but you can kind of think of it as how delta and the bracket, so how the co-bracket and the bracket work together. And this turns out to be an important condition because if this is not true, it turns out you can't quantize this Lie Bai algebra. So although this is kind of weird, and I will explain what this means, this is the important condition. So this dot here means the action, in our case the joint action, right, which is just taking the bracket and continuing it on the tensor product because delta lives in the tensor product. Here I will write this for delta, and I will often leave out the summation sign, right? I will just write A1, A2, and assume we will sum over all the possible A1, A2. Yeah? So don't worry if you don't get all these conditions. I will write down an example, and we will work through this through these things. Right. So let's just start with the example. I wanted to look at the same algebra drawer mentioned at the beginning of his talk, the Heisenberg algebra, although I will denote it slightly different. So I will start with x, y equals z, and then z commutes with everything. And to make things easy, I will start with a trivial co-bracket. So delta, so delta, do I write it? I'll write it here. Delta is zero. This obeys all the conditions there, trivially. So now, this is a bit of a boring example, but things will get more interesting as we go along.
So this is three-dimensional, right?
Yeah.
What field are you considering?
Oh, sorry, it's over C. Mm-hmm. Although, if we quantize things, we will get an H and stuff, but for now it's just C. Alright, and in the end we want to make a connection to Hopf algebras. So, as you know, Hopf algebras can be quasi-triangular. So, also for this, this Lie Bai algebras, we also have a condition, a quasi-triangularity condition, and this is the case when delta is a one co-boundary in this cohomology, meaning that we can write delta as some as the action of this of x or some other of where x is some element of this Lie algebra on some element R in the tensor product. And this R has to obey some conditions for delta to be a co-bracket, of course. We can't just take any R, that won't work. So here are the conditions. So this has to be invariant. But more importantly, so this is often the case. You can easily write down things that are. Just take some combination of the basis elements, some kind of Casimir thing. But more importantly, we have this condition, and this is called the classical Young-Baxter equation, right? And later on, this will become the linear term in the quantum Young-Baxter equation.
So when you write R sub 1, 2?
Yes. I mean...
In the fourth line, you really mean R and not just the sub-end, right?
R 1, 2?
No, 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 the line before.
Oh, here. So this means... this is R, right? But to indicate I switch the indices, so I switch the entries. So you might write tau of R here, yeah. If you take this tau here.
The invariance under the action of G means
yeah, so
zero.
The same. Yeah, if you apply this action on this element, it has to stay the same. Right?
The same or zero?
No, it's I think the same. It's invariant, meaning you don't want it to change under the action of...
I mean, in the Lie word, you often mean...
Maybe I looked over this condition too quickly. Maybe it is zero, but anyway, I don't use this condition that often.
So it's zero.
It's zero? All right. Then it's zero.
In general, it should have text epsilon or hop function.
Oh, right, okay.
In the algebra case, everyone is primitive, so...
Oh, right, okay. All right, well, this illustrates that I don't know this condition that well. I just, and to be honest, I don't use this framework that often because once we have the Lie-Bai algebra, we continue to the Hopf algebra setting. This is just to give you an idea because this is often much easier to compute. Well, anyway, there's a nice way to construct this classical R matrix using the classical quantum double. For that we need a pairing. I already talked about the dual, so you have a pairing, and there's some conditions on this how this delta and the bracket behave under this pairing, and that's the following condition, and this is somewhat equivalent to the Hopf algebra setting, and that goes for all the things in the Lie-Bai algebra settings. Right. Now we have the classical double, and note that we can also get two infinite dimensional Lie algebras, but they are not dual because, that's a little bit more non-trivial in infinite dimensional setting, but we call them paired. We call two Lie-Bai algebras with this pairing dually paired. Right? And that's enough to give you the classical double. And we built this double on the G star tensor G. And we define the Lie algebra on this tensor sum as follows. And you can forget about these relations, because I will show you some much an easier way to compute things. And I will apply that to this example.
Sorry, you're talking about tensor, but the symbol you're using is direct sum.
Yeah, direct sum, sorry, I mean tensor sum, direct sum.
So you mean
sum? Yeah, sum. G star, notice that we switch the product here in the double. So we have AC and here is CA. That's one important thing, because that gives rise to a lot of troubles with minus signs in practice. You should not forget which bracket you're using, if it's a double bracket or just a bracket on your dual Lie algebra. So now we have two nice relations, which you can prove using the definition. That's not hard. And this is just for a simple case. So we assume that A and D are in G star and B and C are in G. And in this case, these relations hold. So, to compute the bracket, the double bracket, you can compute this bracket in the ordinary Lie algebra. And the same goes for the other side. So you can switch between the double and the ordinary bracket. And once you have those relations on the generators, you can calculate it. Things easily on the Lie-Bai algebra. So in practice, this, these are the relations we use to compute this the double of these things. So I will show you how. Any questions so far? Right. So, so in this case, I'll go back to the these relations. So you see, we can get a bracket on the dual from the co-bracket on the non-dual, meaning we should of course first introduce the dual basis. So this will be x, I will write capitals, x, y, and big z. And now we want to compute the relations between those generators. And of course, big and small pairs to 1, and otherwise it's 0. Now what we do, we want to compute x, x and y, and we, and this is kind of making a lucky guess here. So knowing that this gives little z, I will guess that this should give something with a big z. So if there should, if this should be anything, it should have, it should be paired with the little z. Otherwise, it will give 0 anyway. So I will write a small z here. But now, as you can see, we can switch the delta to the other side, or the bracket to the other side. So this will become x tensor y and delta of z. But by assumption, this is 0. So this is 0. And as you can see, whatever we take here, this will be 0 because our co-bracket is 0. So in this way, we see that the bracket of x and y is 0. And for all the other relations, we have the same. So this is a nice nice start. So x, z, equals 0. So now we want to have the co-bracket, and we start with, for example, delta of x. And we should pair it with two elements, right? So let's say a tensor B, right? Now we switch it. So maybe I have a stand here. So become So, as you can see, we're looking for two elements of G, which will give a bracket, which have a bracket, which will become little x, because that's the only element which pairs non-zero with big x. So, in this case, there is no such, there are no such elements, because it's all zero, or it will become z. So, in this case, we see that the delta of z of x will just be 0. The same goes for y, but now big x. So now for the z, right? Delta of big z. And I'll directly guess, so we want to pair it with this set. So if we take x and y here, what we will get if we take the co-bracket to the other side, right, we will get z paired with bracket of x comma y, which will give 1 since the bracket is 1, right? Now if you switch these entries, you will get a minus 1. So in the end, you get delta of z is x tensor y minus y tensor x, which I will abbreviate as x wedge y. Right? It's clear so far? It is not too hard actually, but what we will see is the same, and the reason I'm doing this is the same way of working goes through in the Hopf algebra setting. The only difference is that this is far easier to compute, and you don't have to worry about these h's. And also, once you have the quasi-triangular structure on the Lie-Bay algebra, this gives you a nice intuition as to what how your quantized enveloping algebras should behave, and what the R matrix should look like, and stuff like that. And that's very nice to have, and to check minus signs and stuff like that. Right. All right. So now we want to have this quasi-triangular structure, and as you can see here, FA denotes a dual basis of this basis of G. Right. So we can directly write down the classical R matrix being just the sum. So this is the dual of, we started with the small letters, right? So we will get x tensor x. Is that right? Yeah. Plus y tensor y plus z tensor z. Right? And this is the elegance of the double construction, and this is the same elegance that you can observe, in the quantum double of the construction. So this gives you a very nice intuition about this whole construction. All right, so this is all I have to say about the Lie-Bay algebra stuff. Now I'll continue to the Hopf algebra setting. All right. So you heard about the definition of the Hopf algebra, so I'll skip over the bi-algebra definitions, right? Is there anything I can say here? No, this is just some standard stuff. Notice definition of co-associativity, that this will also be important later on. Yeah, that's it. So now what makes this bi-algebra structure a Hopf algebra? That's if we, on top of this bi-algebra structure, also have an antipode. And how should this stuff all behave together? So, well, this is technically is a bi-algebra condition. This too, right? This is the only condition which you have for the Hopf algebra setting, the lower one. And what you can see from this lower condition is that the S plays a minor role in all of this. What are the important things? Well, that's the multiplication and the co-multiplication. And once you have those, you can guess what the S is. And that's what I will do. I will kind of forget about this S until we need it. Simply because the hardest part is guessing the delta and then the multiplication, right?
So formally, this sign plus, what does it mean?
It's a vector space. It has a vector space structure. right below it. So
that's all.
Yeah, that's all. It's not much. You can add elements. Yeah, so all these things are continued linearly, right? Note that S should be an anti-homomorphism. So this is quasi-triangularity. What can I say about that? Well, this co-commutativity, which I mentioned before, you can see the R matrix as a kind of way to measure how non-co-commutative your Hopf algebra is. That's a nice intuition, I think. Moreover, I will use this notation, where I will sometimes omit this summation sign again, and I will use this notation, Rij, which means putting the first entry on the ith tensor product, on the ith entry, and the second one on the jth entry there.
Just to be sure, the transposition map is just what you wrote?
Yeah, that's the same map. Okay. That's the same map. Same term, yeah. So you see there's already a kind of connection between Hopf algebras. And also there will be a nice connection between this R matrix and the classical R matrix I wrote down over there. So this is the Young-Bechtel equation you all know, probably. And this is the one we're trying to solve. So with some more structure, we can define some elements using the R matrix, right? If you have a quasi-triangular Hopf algebra, you can define these elements U and V, and from those, you can construct the ribbon elements.
So now we are using Gross notation, is that right?
That's possible.
In your Young-Bechtel.
Sorry, Gross notation was what? So what part is unclear?
You know, I'm not saying it's unclear, I'm just saying on the previous, on one of those lights where you have theorem 8, I don't know where this is.
Next slide.
Yes. I see 1, 3.
Yeah.
1, 3. And that's
1, 2, 1, 3 and 2, 3, and that's this notation. Right, so that means this means multiply only the 1 on the 1 on the first entry, right? And then just put the 1 half of the R matrix on the second entry and 1 half on the third entry. That's what this multiplication means on the tensor product.
Okay, so I take it back, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? And that's what the Young-Bechtel equation is. So the ribbon element is also not crucial. You can compute it once you have computed the co-product and your antipode. So I won't compute it here now. Although in practice you can check, you can kind of get an intuition what this ribbon element should be from computing S squared. That should give you some idea of what these elements U and V should do, and then if you want to be sure, you just use this formula to compute U and V. So that's it. Now we go to the pairing. And again, we have H and G, which are dually paired as vector spaces. And then if we want them to be dually paired as Hopf algebras, we have a list of conditions, right? And that's this list. And this should remind you of the conditions we had on the bi-algebra, right? Again, you see you can kind of switch from the co-multiplication to the multiplication on the other one, on the other half, and back. We have some conditions for the co-unit and for the antipode, but these are the ones to focus on. That's where we will get the co-multiplication from, and the multiplication on the dual. What did I write here? Strict dual. Yeah, so you don't want your pairing to be degenerate. But that's not a problem because you can always make you're pairing a non-degenerate. And again, you can do this for infinite dimensional in an infinite dimensional setting, but then this will be just a pairing, and they won't be duals necessarily. Right, but that's the setting we are interested in. As long as we obey these conditions, we're happy. All right, so now what this talk is all about, the quantum double, or Drinfeld double. So that's what I said, infinite dimensional pairing. One technicality, again, as we observed in the Lie-Bai algebras, in the double we need the opposite multiplication. And I will denote this as the H star op, which is just the H star but with the negated multiplication. And I will write things like this, as
so,
I did.
What is the opposite multiplication?
It's just the multiplication with a minus sign. So this is again a Hopf algebra.
But no exchange.
So if you have mu, which is your or m to be consistent with other terms, you can define or if you have this how did they write it, m I j k, then you have the your m op is just switching the indices, the I and the j.
But you said something about the minus sign?
Yeah.
The bracket does.
The bracket, sorry, yeah. So the bracket has the... but that's not... Hopf algebras, that's not what we work with. So in this case, it's just switching the entries.
Okay.
Yeah. Opposite. Right. Okay. And then this is the definition. So what's important here again? We're working on a tensor product of the dual with the Hopf algebra itself, or alternatively with the dually paired Hopf algebra here in this entry that works as well. And on this tensor product, we define the following product, which uses your antipode, which is the pairing, which is the product here. And again here, you see B and A are switched. So here A becomes first, here A becomes last. And that's what I mean with a quasi-triangle generated by H and H star op as such Hopf algebras. Again, in practice, you can use this, but it's if you do things by hand, if you don't put it in a computer program, you can. It's easier to use the axioms of the pairing to compute your co-bracket and your bracket on the dual, and then, you still have to use this formula. that's what makes it a little bit harder. You don't have these nice. Things as in the Lie-Bai algebra setting. All right, so this was the part about Hopf algebras. All right, let's see, how do I want to do this? What we can do here to give you a quick example and of how things should look like is define the universal enveloping algebra of your Lie algebra, and on this, so this is just a tensor algebra only divided out by so these relations. So this is tensor algebra of G divided by A B minus B A minus the bracket of A and B. And now you can make this into a Hopf algebra. And what you can do is define the co bracket of an element as tensor A, and this will together with the antipode will turn this stuff into a Hopf algebra. Together with, of course, the unit and the co-unit. But that's just putting a 1 here or deleting a 1 here. Alright? and this algebra is the one we want to quantize. This Hopf algebra is the one we want to deform. But this is the starting point. And as you can see, if we put in the antipode here, we get 0 as we want, right? If we as with the axiom. Right, the last, we can check this one easily, because if we apply S tensor ID to delta of A, we get a minus sign on the first one, so we get minus tensor 1, minus A tensor 1 plus 1 tensor A, and if we use the multiplication defined by this relation, right, we get, since the bracket of A and 1 of any element with 1 is that is 0, right, trivially, we get that this is minus A plus A, which is 0. Now, this seems a trivial computation, but later on you want to... This is the way to obtain this S, right? If you want to obtain the antipode, this is the computation to do. And then it's like solving an equation. Namely, you want this equation to become zero. All right. Quantization of Lie by algebras and Hopf algebras. So first we need to talk about, so this is what I said, this is a definition of the universal enveloping algebra. Co-commutative. Since this co bracket, right, since the co-multiplication is trivial, right, since this is co-commutative, if you apply tau to this, it stays the same, we have a trivial R matrix. So, in particular, this is a quasi-triangular Hopf algebra with a trivial R matrix. So, deformations. So this is the point where things get a little bit messy, and there's lots of issues with once we have this. So it's easy to say a topological Hopf algebra, but then you have all kinds of issues with the basis. So especially with when we obtain this deformation from a Lie by algebra, but I will skip over these issues because in our case they are not important, because our case is a little bit easier and we can get a basis from the Lie algebra structure. But in general, this will you need to think about things having to do with this power series and basis elements and stuff. All right. What's the first condition on this Hopf algebra, on the deformation over a K, which is just a power series ring in some indeterminate H? We want this Hopf algebra to be isomorphic to H as a KH module. So it should be, you can pull through powers of H. Again, we want the mu of H it should be a deformation, right? So it should have something to do with this mu we start with, and the same goes for this delta of h. And these are the conditions. So modulo h, they should reduce to the old co-bracket and bracket. And that's what you can see in many examples, is that if you take if you set h to zero, you reduce stuff to this, to the to this universal enveloping algebra. So and now there's this whole deformation theory. When can you deform things? And then you want to talk about the equivalence of two deformations. I won't talk about that too much. There's something in the slides all the way in the back, but and that's pretty interesting too. But I won't mention that now. But anyway, we want there to be an isomorphism of Hopf algebras, which should reduce to the identity, which kind of, it's kind of the same thing as we said here. Now, what is a quantized universal enveloping algebra? That's just the deformation of a universal enveloping algebra. Right, so this is the thing we want to do. We want to find certain deformations of the quanta of the universal enveloping algebra, and this should and not just any deformation, right? We want to keep our Lie by algebra structure. That's what I said. We want this to mirror the Hopf algebra image. So, in some sense, this delta should be incorporated in your quantization.
What do you mean by identity model?
So if you so this isomorphism shouldn't change anything about the zero power of h, right? If you you can write down elements as of h, etc. So h2 h squared, and certain meaning, it should only do things on this part.
Oh, okay.
Right? And that's the same thing we want here. So we don't want this deformation to do anything on the trivial part of our Hopf algebra, right? We don't want our deformation to change the things we started with, to change this original Hopf algebra. We just want it to add some additional structure to the Hopf algebra. And that's the same thing, so that's why we don't want this isomorphism to change anything about the Hopf algebra we started with.
Could you give an example of two deformations which are not equivalent? Maybe we can talk later.
So this is what I talked about, and what we talked about yesterday a little bit. This is deformation theory, and you can look at the cohomology of your Hopf algebra, and if the second cohomology class is zero,
yeah,
then all of these deformations are equivalent, and then if the third one is zero, then well, etc.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole nice theory about that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But speaking about examples, so we need one. Maybe I'll just give an example now.
I understand. Is the constant deformation, like a deformation?
Yeah, you have trivial deformation.
It's still.
It's a deformation. Yeah, sure. If you have no power, if you don't add anything, so this is a deformation of itself,
mm-hmm,
in particular.
So the action of h in this sense is zero.
Yeah. But that's not what we are interested in. Does it make it clear?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So let's write down the Hopf algebra for this for this guy. All right, so since the... All right. Sorry for the things. I think I will just continue with the definitions, then we've had everything, and then we can calculate stuff. So we need to extend. So as you saw, I didn't use the Lie-Bayer algebra structure here, right? I just used the Lie algebra structure because I divided out by the bracket. And what we want to do now is we want to kind of extend the Lie-Bayer algebra structure to this universal enveloping algebra. And the way to do this is using this Coe-Poisson-Hopf algebras. Luckily for us, we don't have to worry about these things because, it has some axioms, but there's also a nice theorem that says every, what does it say? So the Lie co-bracket extends to a Poisson co-bracket uniquely on the universal enveloping algebra and the other way around. So we can just view this Coe-Poisson, we can just forget about this Coe-Poisson structure and use our Lie-Bayer algebra bracket on the generators. And that's what we will do, because we will check everything on the generators. We won't check everything on all the tensor products, because that's not useful. Right? But I need to say this because we need this for a quantization of a Hopf algebra. So if we have a co-commutative Coe-Poisson Hopf algebra, right, which is just Hopf, for example, a Hopf algebra which arises in this way from this universal enveloping algebra, we have one additional condition, and that is we want to keep our delta around, and we want to keep it in this way. Now, what does this say? This kind of says that in the first order, our deformed co-multiplication should look like this delta. Right? That's what it says. So here we have the opposite co-multiplication. Again, meaning just switching. I hope this is the wrong one. Switching the entries, right? And so now we have a little bit more information, and we already had from the previous definition of deformation that the zeroth order should look like the Hopf algebra we started with. But now we know that the first order should look like the Lie-Bayer algebra structure we had, right? And this is very useful in computing deformations or quantizations of Hopf algebras. Now some terminology. So you can quantize a Lie-Bayer algebra this way, and this means quantizing its universal enveloping algebra. Again, we also have a classical limit, namely just the Lie-Bayer algebra we started with. There's some nice...
A little bit confusing now. So you said I start with the Lie algebra.
Yeah.
So I forget about co-bracket. Forget about co-bracket, I can still compute the universal enveloping.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I can compute the
deformation. Yes.
But then you say the co-bracket from the Lie algebra uniquely extends.
No, so this is...
So this Coe-Poisson co-bracket.
Yes, so that's the... Yeah.
So I'm confused now. The quantization...
Yeah, I understand.
But this new thing, is it a condition or is it just a...
This is a condition. No, this is a condition. This is a definition. Right? This is a smaller subset of the deformation, of the set of deformations we had. We're selecting certain deformations which obey this condition. So before we could deform this Hopf algebra in any way we wanted, we could just add some H's as long as this whole thing is still a Hopf algebra and if zeroth order stayed the same, right? And now we want it, we have some additional conditions on the first term, on the term linear in H.
Okay.
And that's the new thing here. And this delta, and that's the thing you were probably confused about, this delta can be viewed as the co-bracket, but formally this delta here is the co-Poisson, or the Poisson co-bracket. And that's
and how this small delta arises if you have U H of G, and how delta small arises?
Well, then you start with a bi algebra, right? You start, that's a condensation of a Lie bi algebra. You always start with a co bracket,
yeah.
And then this co bracket of your Lie bi algebra here, that's the same as that delta there.
Yeah, but it was the Lie co-bracket, why it's becoming Poisson co-bracket?
Right, because that's what the theorem says. So this extends to a co-Poisson bracket, meaning that it stays the same on the generators of the Lie algebra, right? So if you put in a generator here, you just get a Lie bracket. Mm-hmm. But if you put in some tensor product here, then you have to use this co-Poisson structure.
This is Hart theorem, or
not so? No. It's not Hart. It's just checking. It's just extending it in this way, and then checking that it obeys all the right axioms. And well, of course, that it's unique. All right. And again, everything, all these theorems are also in the references, and they prove all things there. So this is more, the talk is meant to give you the machinery needed to compute things. And that's because that's what I do, for the moment at least. and again, so this second, this is not really theorem, this is just stating something. The second one is interesting though, because it says we can obtain the quasi-triangular Lie bi algebra structure from this deformed Hopf algebra, or from this quantized universal enveloping algebra. So if it is quasi-triangular, then the classical limit is also quasi-triangular. That's what this says. And that's why the intuition, why we can get some idea of how our Hopf algebra should look like from looking at this Lie bi algebra structure. And again, this looks the same as the condition we put on delta here. It's also a condition on the second, or the first order. So now we know a little bit about how our R matrix should look like, right? It should look like one tensor one plus H times R and some additional stuff. But this is the first information we have without even computing anything. Now, luckily, these deformations exist. That's what this theorem says. So, if we have this is finite dimensional, for finite dimensional Lie bi algebra. But this is more, this is just an existence theorem. And it's nice to have. Let's see.
So
all right.
How does the little r define the bi algebra again?
So the little r defines the bi algebra in the sense that you have the delta equals right, the delta of some element is just the action of that element on your R matrix. That's if you have a quasi-triangular structure. So you start with a Lie algebra, and then this R matrix defines a Lie Bi algebra structure on this Lie algebra.
So, so here you look at real finite dimensional. Before it was
But it also works for complex
finite dimensional.
Yeah, finite dimensional Lie algebras. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm confused. Maybe I missed something. I thought that was a conjecture of Drinfeld, not a theorem of Drinfeld.
Oh, really?
Which was later proven by Ettinghoff and Kashdan. I mean, isn't
it's triangular here.
It's triangular. Okay, so it's just.
Yeah.
So then it's actually not the case we care about. Okay.
I don't know which part was the conjecture of.
No. So then, sorry.
This is old.
Sorry, so I take it back.
No, I just took this from the book, so they mentioned Drinfeld here and not the other ones. So.
Yeah, because the other ones came after.
Yeah.
But it's a weaker theorem than the one we actually need.
No, the second part I think is weaker, right? Because
The R that you use is not the R that the R that appears in this theorem is not the kind of R's that we need.
It's because it has this the second thing.
No, right? The lowercase R. So I got it.
Oh, I didn't study this theorem extensively because I assumed it also worked for our case, but maybe you know the specifics.
No, so I think it doesn't. So I think the theorem, at least the one in the books, mm-hmm. Shari, Presley, etc., is actually too weak for for the R's we need.
Oh, really? And there's no theorem?
There is, and it's a thing of Kashdan, and it comes later.
Oh, okay. All right. Well,
can you just maybe formulate this? What is going on here?
Sorry? So, it's whether what exactly is the lowercase r matrix supposed to satisfy? So, I think the theorem that appears in the Chari Presley is that lowercase r plus r to 1 is equal to 0. Assumes that lowercase r plus r to 1 is equal to 0. Am I right, Roland? I don't exactly remember. I think it's lowercase r plus r to 1 is equal to 0, as opposed to simply being invariant.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Yeah, that's a strong condition, yeah.
So the
triangular versus non-triangular, quasi-triangular.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what this is. This is the stronger condition, the triangularity condition, but on the...
Remember that they also give a...
So here it's just
invariant. But that's wrong.
Ah, that's wrong.
That paper by Vershetichin is apparently wrong.
Oh, okay.
Which paper?
Also, this theorem, it's quite simple, right?
Yeah.
A theorem that was supposed to prove
Ettinghoff
Kashdan, but didn't.
Well, otherwise you don't have this
nice... So here it definitely says invariant.
Yeah, but you can
imagine. Yeah.
So then this doesn't match the actual theorem.
It doesn't match.
What?
Let's go on. I mentioned this because but they exist, these deformations, and apparently there's a strong theorem which
they
works
exist,
for
but
our
but case. They're much harder than you would imagine you would think.
All right. Yeah, because in practice it's also quite hard to obtain them. Yeah. All right.
We are here in order to understand something. So,
yeah.
What's going on here? So, in your slides, you say R12 plus R21 is invariant on the action of G.
Yeah. So this is a weaker condition than the triangularity condition. So you have quasi-triangular, meaning that this R12 plus R21 is invariant, and you have the condition which says that the R21 is the inverse.
No. Now you're confusing a smaller case and bigger. And
uppercase
and lowercase.
I don't know the triangular definition for the.
So here it's basically asking that sum is zero, not just an invariant vector. Under that condition, it is zero.
Okay, so if I take the quantum group that's always written on the board,
mm-hmm.
Rinfeld, Kono, blah, 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 Jimbo.
Yeah.
Is R12 plus R21 zero, or is it just invariant?
Invariant.
Yeah, that's invariant.
It's not zero.
I don't think so. No, because it's a harder.
It
the,
is.
The, as Dror said, it's not the easy case. Information, I think.
So for the real life quantum groups.
We don't need this condition. We don't need this theorem apparently, but we need the one by Eddinghoff. But that's, I didn't know that either. So thank you for correcting. I refer to the drawer for further. and to the books, but not the ones I listed because they don't say things about that. Alright, so the example. That's what's important because this deformation exists. Alright. So what we want to do is we want to first quantize these halves, these halves separately, and then put them together using the quantum double. So as I said, and in this case we just use the definition, and in particular we use this definition to get some inspiration. In this lowercase algebra, we see that the delta is zero, so the first order of our delta is also zero, so we can just take the trivial co-multiplication. Etc. On the other one, we have this condition, right? So we can make a guess. And the way I usually guess is looking at, and in this case, this guess works because it's a very easy algebra, and we don't need to worry about the compatibility between the multiplication and the co-multiplication, because there is no, the multiplication on this side of the algebra is trivial, so we just can write down any sensible co-bracket and this will do the job.
So are these small x's or big x's?
These?
Yes.
That's small. This is the, maybe I can write it down in the same way I wrote it down there. So in this is small x, and this is just x times 1 plus 1. Right? And the same goes for y and z. It's also the same. So just to write it down, this is y tensor 1, 1. Y, and this is Z. So that's trivial. On the other side, since the bracket on X and Y, the co-bracket on X and Y is zero, we can just take the same trivial, right? So I say trivial, so this is the co-bracket of the universal enveloping algebra. So this is you said, I guess, about taking the trivial deformation, and that's what we're kind of doing here. But luckily it's not all trivial.
And now we are somehow writing the double, is that right?
No, I'm not doing the double. I'm not touching the double, I'm just quantizing. I'm just looking at the deformations of these Lie-by algebras. Right? These are two Lie-by algebras, which a priori are not connected in any way. And right now, that's how I look at them. Right now, I'm just guessing some quantization of these Lie-by algebras. right? So I'm making these two, I'm using these Lie Pi algebras as an inspiration to obtain a Hopf algebra, other than the universal enveloping algebra. Right, I'm just writing down the co-bracket.
Co-product.
Does that make sense to you? So that's why I put the line in the middle, because if you erase this, you can just view these as...
I mean, let's invite a dual pi algebra, right?
Yeah, but we don't do anything yet with this duality.
Okay.
Right? Because each side separately should make sense as a Lie Pi algebra.
Mm-hmm.
And in practice, if you want to get the UQSL2, that's why you do a 2. Of course, you have to know beforehand what that... You have to start with the right dual algebras. Right, because otherwise things don't make sense. But apart from that, if you have the dual Lie Pi algebra, you can just quantize them separately and then put them together.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So now the non-trivial. So of course the zero of order should look like this. But now, in the first order, if you what you have to obtain the co-bracket, right? The Lie co-bracket. So remember that it could be written like this. So my guess in this case would be just to put an h times x tensor y behind this, because when I subtract this, so let's check it for a moment, right? So the delta, so the opposite co-multiplication of z is given by switching the entries. So this is 1 tensor z plus z tensor 1 plus h y tensor x, right? This is the opposite co-multiplication. Now what we do, we subtract them. And we divide them by h. So if we do that, you can see that the zeroth order will disappear, right? Because this is the same as this part. What we are left with is this part minus this part, which is just equal to h times x tensor y minus y tensor x. And you see, if we divide by h, this is exactly our original co-bracket. Right? Does it make sense? This is the way to use this condition to kind of guess these things. And this is a very easy case in which this condition is enough to obtain the right co-bracket, co-multiplication, sorry. However, if things are become more difficult, you have to invoke the other conditions, because you want this to be a Hopf algebra. So what you want to do in particular is demand that this thing I wrote down is a homomorphism, right? So now it's time to go back to the original Hopf algebra, right? You want to impose this condition on your co-multiplication, and this gives you some form if you make an ansatz about this. That's the way to quantize things. You just guess and then make your guess as general as possible, and then invoke conditions on your ansatz. Luckily for us, we could just write down the thing that made sense, but in general you have to write down something more complicated, and that's the case with SL2. I don't think I'll get to that, but...
So when you do it like this, is it now co-associative?
So is it co-associative?
I mean, I would expect to need higher powers of H also. And one reason might be that it's not co-associative if you don't...
Well, yeah, so what's the co-associativity? And that's just... That's this.
Anyway, I just want the answer. Wait. Is it like this, or are there higher terms in H?
No, I think it's like this. I could be wrong, but because I didn't explicitly check this, but did... No, I did. I'm right. We did check this, and it's like this. Yeah, sorry. No, this is a special case of... it's a small part of the SL3 invariant of the SL3 version of Jordan Roland's invariant. Only for epsilon is zero. As you can see, this x, y, and z, I call them this because in the SL3 you also have three upper... You're a very upper triangular part. But anyway, that's why I know that it's like this.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, we were lucky. Yeah. But in general, it's not obvious, and you should. That's one of the conditions you should put on your code notification. Yes. All right, but the thing, and that's really what the important part is, that's why we're doing this whole construction. So that's, and that's all about computing a dual basis. So to obtain this R matrix, remember it's like, R is F A tensor E of H of A, right? So here F is a dual basis to this. So equals 1, and if we take, as Dreuer said, we should do, and luckily in this case, because our algebra is that simple, we can also use the same logic. Namely, we can use monomials in our dual, right? We just take and said, oh, but we don't know how this pairs. So it's not 1 because of, well, okay. So let's write it down. And we want to know this in order to get the right dual basis, because we can use this, but it's not yet. We have to correct it with some number, and in this case, it turns out that this is just n factorial times n factorial times O factorial. So we obtain this dual basis. So let me write it like this. So F N M O equals X to the N, Y to the M, Z to the O, divided by N M O. Right? So this is dual to our original basis. And again, in general, you can just, we're lucky that we can just take these three elements and that they will form a basis. But in general, you don't have this Z and your algebra, your quantizations will become, so for people who know a little bit about the root system, about the roots of Lie algebras, in general, we only have elements corresponding to the simple roots. And we don't have elements corresponding to the non-simple roots. And in our case, we do, because our bi-algebra structure is very simple. But in general, you don't have this luxury, and you have to use the quantum Weyl group to obtain these other elements and to form a basis. So in general, this can become very complicated, and this is one of the obstructions of doing this quantum double construction. And this is one of the hard parts there. But in, I chose this Lie algebra because in this case this is not so hard, and we can just take this basis and compute the pairing, right? And in this case, of course, I forgot, but since it's dual, we should have the Kronecker deltas here. So this is one if they're equal and zero otherwise. And another thing is, I wrote them down in this way, but you can switch the order of the bases here. You can switch the order of the monomials, and in general, if you switch the order, you will also obtain another structure on your algebra, on another co-algebra structure. But in this case, I chose the easy one and the obvious one. But this will also correspond to lots of differences between what you might read in the literature and what you might do yourself. This can, well, just the one. Anyway, we can finish the calculation now because we can write down the R matrix. The R of H. Which is just...
So now we're talking about the double?
Yes. Yes. This is the double construction. And now I'm skipping a part. Because I'm running out of time. But in general, we have calculated, we have quantized, right? We have quantized the dual, our Lie bi algebra and its dual. And now we have to Hopf algebras, and we can just write down this quantum double construction. And it's only a matter of writing down things because this Drinfeld construction gives us everything. So in particular, I can just write down the R matrix. And that's the magic of the quantum double. So I want to connect to other parts. And in this case, R equals so we have an R of H to the I, if we sum over I, J and K, so this is I, J plus K divided by because here there's also an h to the power of n plus, or rather a 1 over h. And this reflects the fact that I was sloppy introducing this h, because I should have put a different basis here, which had like this. But I forgot about that, so that's why we're ending up with negative powers of h. But that doesn't matter, because you can always introduce this power of h by some isomorphism. In any case, if we use a correct correction term here, we end up with I factorial j factorial k factorial times xi y j z k tensor x I y j z of k, and as you can see, this can be written in a very nice form, namely e to the power of h times x tensor little x plus y tensor little y plus z tensor little z. And the only problem in turning this into the quantum into a not invariant is computing, or is trying to figure out how to put these R matrices together. So, for example, you might want to compute. In general, this is quite hard, and this is also one of the problems in the construction. But once you have it, you can just put it into a computer program, and that will do, and Mathematica will do the rest, or some other language.
So here you just write some of the identity as, in the tensor product. So where does the delta op even enter this sum game?
That's the delta here, is in fact that I put I equal to I here.
But I mean this extra term, where does it enter this game?
Which extra term? Oh, right. So this extra term enters the game in computing the bracket, right? So that's one of the parts I skipped over quickly to get to this point. But if you compute product, so for example x to the I little x to the I prime, one thing, let's compute a simple case, so x squared comma x squared, right? One thing we can do here is turn this thing into a tensor product, but then at the cost of turning this, of giving this a coproduct. Mm-hmm. This is equal to using the fact that delta is a homomorphism. Right, and in this case, the only things that pair non-zero with this thing are terms like this, little x tensor little x.
Yes.
And that's just a matter of counting here.
But for z, it might not be true.
Well, exactly. So in z, we obtain other terms. So. Right, so if you write z here, in this case we are lucky again, because we remember that in this version, right, the bracket of x and y is zero. So you are worried that we might get an additional z, right, on this side, if we apply the co-bracket. So if you write this out...
But we know that we get some x and y's.
Yes, and for on this side, the delta, little delta, of z. So this is little z, is trivial. So you don't get the x and y's there. That's the whole point. See? This is big z.
Yes.
This is little z. And that's just... there's no x and y there.
But maybe you see it better if you start multiplying.
Yeah, I can start multiplying.
So what is small z times big z?
Well, yeah, you can.
The quantum double.
If you compute it,
you see.
So that's one other part I didn't write down, but you can write down the relations of the quantum double, because in the end that's how you that's also things you need to compute these how to commute these R matrices. And in this case, we have the following relations. So big Z times little Z, as Roland asked, is zero. But there's a few non-zero, namely big Z with little X gives us Y. And big Z with little Y gives us minus X. And all other things are zero. So this is the full quantum double, and this is just, you can calculate this with the definition. So, but the important part is the co-multiplication here, because that's, in the end, that's where you get, that's how you compute the pairing between these monomials, right? And that's the bare minimum you need to compute the R matrix. Then once you have the R matrix, you need to know these relations because you want to commute these things. And well, that's what you did. But to get to the R matrix, you just need a co, the co product. Yeah. Any other questions?
So let me try to see whether I understand this. So we say the right hand side. Is non-trivial the left hand side is non-trivial Lie algebra, but trivial delta.
Yes.
Trivial little delta.
This side. Yeah. Delta is zero. Mm-hmm. So
therefore, you can just take the universal enveloping algebra without any deformation.
Exactly.
Whatsoever.
And that's what we did here.
And you call this quantum.
Yeah.
Quantum,
we call this
quantum deformation, but
yes.
Actually, it's not deformed at all.
Yes. Yes, it's a trivial deformation.
But that's your H.
Yes.
Capital H. And then the right hand side, you deform.
This is the dual, right? We deform
it's
the dual.
It's a dual by algebra.
Yeah.
But now you have a little bit of deformation in the co-product.
Yeah.
But then you say, I know on general grounds that this produces again a Hopf algebra, which would be dual to the one before.
Well, so.
And then you say, just those two, if I tensor them together, that's my quantum double.
Well, so in general. If you quantize, at least if you have this kind of trivial co-bracket, right, then what happens, and also if you have this small Lie Bi algebra, and I don't know how it works in bigger cases, but you get an isomorphism between these cases. So between, I'll say, UQ of some Lie algebra, the dual, but in general this is not, I don't know if this is true, but in the cases where we are working this is true. Mm-hmm. And you should look at this in a case by case scenario. So the way to do this is of course first quantize your original Lie Bi algebra, right? Then use that quantization to compute the dual Hopf algebra, and then from that side you can compute the quantum double. That's the correct way to do things. Mm-hmm. In this and in other simple cases, you can just forget about this structure and you do this separately. But right? just to summarize what we did. So we did some Hopf algebra deformations, we did Lie algebras, and we looked at how we could go from a Lie algebra to a Hopf algebra to a quantized universal enveloping algebra. And then we looked at how to get a quasi-triangular structure on these Hopf algebras by the quantum double, right? And so in particular we did this example. In general, there's lots, as I said, there's lots of little things you have to worry about. So there's the minus signs in the definition of the quantum double, there's the isomorphisms between the these kind of things. If you use the Lie algebra as a kind of inspiration, you have another isomorphism, the one between A of H of the deformation and this one. That's one thing to worry about when you're looking at basis elements, and if you want to obtain a Poincaré-Birkhoff width basis, if that means anything to you. So things can get a little bit messy, but at least the bottom line is very evident, I think. Yeah. And if you want to know anything about SL2, so this is the Lie algebra structure on SL2. Just to have mentioned it, because other people will use it. And you can quantize this, and then you will obtain the U cube SL2. Alright, that's it.
Can you show the slide summary?
Yes. Yeah.
So is that exponential really an exponential?
In this case it is, yeah.
So, but the little x and y don't commute, right? Don't you get some problems there?
Well, in this case I wrote, you get problems there.
That's an ordered exponential.
Yeah. You have to use the the O operator, right? So, but this is a real exponential. Yeah. So this has to do with the ordering you choose. So if you choose a different ordering, you get different results, right?
And so are you saying that the brackets in the Hopf algebra in the classical double and the quantum double have the same brackets? Same
computation
relations.
That's correct. In this case, they have, but in general, that's not true, of course.
Right.
Luckily, so this is the same for the Lie algebra, so the classical double and the quantum double. But that's just because this Lie algebra I chose is that simple. So in general. As you can, for example, see in the, so this is the Lie, so the SL2 structure, and if you quantize it, you obtain these relations. And this is different, at least this one is different from what you get in the Lie algebra case. But this works the same way as I did here. It's just quantizing the two parts, or one part, and then calculating the dual, calculating the pairing between the two using your new, well, that's what I do here, right? Using your new co-multiplication, and then you have your UQ SL2. It's the same way of doing things. It's only a little bit more difficult.
So just a comment, I saw Vladimir was taking pictures of the slides.
Yeah.
I'm going to pressure Shavo to give me a copy of his slides so that I can post them along with the video. And
very good.